the change in my analysis went from, I'm not actually a patient, I'm just a lump here reporting, to being a patient. I didn't understand the work until after that conference at the TAVI. It's like I could take advantage of the opportunity I was having, you know, to speed along. It was very wonderful. You know, my analyst wrote a paper with two other analysts about their experience of working with three women of color during the Martin Luther King funeral.
Welcome to the IPA podcast. For those of you who have been listeners to the past 40 episodes of this podcast series, you know that we've been focusing on analysts who bring their clinical skills to venues outside of the consulting room, hence the name psychoanalysis on and off the couch. Given that we are all facing together a crisis of unfathomable proportions, we're going to be changing the focus of our podcast. We are going to be interviewing psychoanalysts from all corners of the globe to discuss with them how their local communities are coping with this situation, how their clinical work has been affected by this situation, and also how the internal worlds of both the analyst and the patient have been impacted by this virus, as it impacts both our real fears and our imaginary fears. We're going to encounter not only uncertainty and fear, but we're also going to learn great wisdom, gifted empathy, and hope. We'll be maintaining the title of this podcast, both as a testament to our past work and as a placeholder for our future work. I hope you find these conversations both informative and sustaining. Feel free to write comments on our webpage, IPAoffthecouch.org. Thank you.
Welcome, everyone, to today's podcast. I'm Dr. Stephen Rolfe. I'm an analyst on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Center of Philadelphia and chair of the American Psychoanalytic Association's Committee on Corporate and Organizational Consulting. I'm managing principal of Rolfe Advisory and specialize in psychodynamic leadership advisory services for CEOs, family enterprises, leaders in crisis, and leaders with psychiatric illness. Our guest today is Dr. Kathleen Pogue-White. Dr. White is principal of Pogue-White Consultancy. Kathy is a psychologist and psychoanalyst, an executive coach and organizational consultant, and a Tavistock Group Relations practitioner. She is an experienced educator and was founding member and past director of the organizational program at the William Allison White Institute for Psychology and Psychoanalysis. She's currently a core faculty of the Dynamics of Consulting program in New York, which is an advanced coaching offering. Dr. White's practice is based in Manhattan. Dr. White's consulting career has focused extensively on executive coaching, particularly executive role transitions in many organizations, including the Mellon Foundation, Open Society Foundation, Georgetown University, Teva Pharmaceuticals, Goldman Sachs, and many, many other for-profit and non-for-profit organizations. It's a pleasure to welcome Kathy today to our podcast. Kathy, we are delighted to have you join our podcast this morning. Your work, as well as your professional and personal development, illustrates the principal focus of these podcasts, how contemporary psychoanalysts practice, and how they are utilizing their psychoanalytic insights, understanding, and experience in all sorts of endeavors outside the consulting room, off the couch, if you will. I thought we would begin by hearing a bit about how you came to psychoanalysis or how it came to you.
Right. Thank you for having me. I'm delighted to join you in this set of ideas you're putting forth. My joining into psychoanalysis began actually from a trauma. So I would say that as a Black woman, child, I was protected by my family from what they knew of the histories, brutality, and, you know, lack of humanity and all like that. They protected me from it. And, I was raised by the Jesuits, so that's a whole kind of protection as well. So it wasn't until I was 12 years old when I saw a picture of Emmett Till. You know Emmett Till, right?
Yes, of course.
When I saw his mutilated self on the picture, on the cover of Jet magazine. And so I was sort of instantly brought into reality, I'd say. The defenses dropped immediately. It's like, oh, right, that's us, that's me. There's a little side thing I want to tell you here is that as a result of that sort of way of awakening to my Blackness and all of its history, I have felt terrible guilt. Like I was not available to my people for 12 whole years. I wasn't present. And it makes me feel terrible even today when I think about it. Anyway, that spurred me on to, over the years, become quite involved with Dr. King and his marches and his way of thinking and et cetera. So I was happily going along in college, being a sort of activist and, you know, getting my education. And then it was Kennedy got killed, Malcolm X got killed, Martin Luther King got killed, Robert Kennedy got killed. And so my belief in everything just sort of fell apart. And I was at the time a assistant provost at NYU. And I just decided I'd get analytic training while I was at it. And I think what it meant when I look back on it psychoanalytically, it meant that the depressive response to those huge losses and to the loss of a sort of budding identity, the loss was so intense that I went into hiding. And that's how I think psychoanalysis, I use psychoanalysis defensively. It's like I closed the world down into such a small, teeny little, almost controllable enterprise, and did that for about 35 years, right? And then, as life would have it, you know, I must have incubated enough. I went to a group relations conference. I don't know if you know the Tavistock work on group relations. I'll tell you more about it.
Sure, but yes, tell the audience more. So let me just be clear then for the audience then, yes, that your introduction to psychoanalysis really was your own treatment.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I went into treatment. I skipped that part, interestingly. Yes, I went into treatment around all those losses. Huh? And that coincided with my getting this job at NYU. And since I was at NYU, I could become like my analysts, right? I could train to be an analyst. I had a very positive transference to my analyst once we got over the hatred around race between us. And I felt that the analysis really put me on a path to coming out of sort of this lockdown that I put myself in.
Yeah, so it's an interesting way to think about analysis as a kind of lockdown, mm-hmm, as a protection, like exactly, you were talking about earlier.
Exactly.
Which I think leads us into your paper from which I know was published in 1997, and we'll have a reference to the paper on the website, right, called Applying Learning from Experience.
Right.
So let's talk about that. Let's talk about how you went through TAVI to, I suppose it was A.K. Rice.
No, it's the Tavistock.
It's Tavistock. Okay.
Institution.
Okay.
Which is where I've had all my training, and where my group relations, that's my group relations mother home. You know, it's like when I think of my mother institutions, that's one. A.K. Rice is another. The William Ellen White is another, right? So I went to a conference where at one stage when we were talking about our back home roles, et cetera, I told this guy who was running, I said, well, you know, I'm a PhD. I'm teaching full-time. I'm a professor. And he said to me, what, is that all you're going to do with your life? I was completely floored, right? It's like, I thought I was doing pretty good, right? This one dude tells me that, you know, I missed the mark. And that hit home. It hit home because, you remember, I had been an activist person in the 60s, late 50s, early 60s. And here I was, you know, languishing in academia and as an analyst. So it caught me and made me say to myself, okay, so what are you scared of? And I think the neurotic bits have to do with if I were to be more public, I would, you know, garner more criticism and attack, and I would be shamed. Not an unusual psychological story for Black people. So best I stay in these safe places and, you know, survive on. But then something very interesting happened. I was working at a foundation along with a white colleague, a woman, and our job was to sort of help develop Black entrepreneurs and young CEOs, so that there was a program that was put forth by another organization, and we were faculty. So this was to benefit Black entrepreneurs and folks. So she and I were talking and had started to get quite close, so that we were talking about more intimate things. And I once said to her, you know what? I am so sick of race. I'm done with race. I'm never going to consider it as part of my work ever again. And she said to me, sorry, you have a lot of privileges, but you don't have that privilege, because these young folks who are coming along are standing on your shoulders, whether you like it or not. Okay, so, you know, whammo. Very important observation.
For sure, Kathy. When was that? In connection with this Tavistock conference, I'm wondering.
I don't have the dates firmly in mind, but my sense is that I got that work in that organization post my Tavistock experiences. So I was already, you know, thinking systemically and like that. So when she said, essentially, you know, you're part of a bigger system. You cannot just step out of it. Who do you think you are? I was already primed to be able to hear that. So I think it was post, for sure. Because my first Tavistock conference was in like 73. So, right, I was already, you know, an advocate and fully involved with the TAVI work. So that question to me about who do you think you are woke up both the realization of how much privilege I actually have, and that actually I did have the privilege all before to step away from a difficult world and, you know, be in my own little cocoon. And that, you know, I was exercising a kind of privilege that wasn't becoming of a good Jesuit daughter. By the way, I wanted to be a Jesuit. My poor father had to tell me the truth. He had to educate me to the problem of wanting to be a Jesuit. So I think this was all around the time I'm still, you know, doing analysis, but you realize if I'm taking on a big educational thing like this, my analytic hours are getting cut back, right? So I'm starting to already compromise analysis for opportunities to consult. Anyway, I had a patient at the time who was, we had been working together for about 6-7 years in a classical analysis, and I had to change an appointment with her that was going to take like over 2 weeks. Again, I had to travel someplace because the world of consulting does not care about your patient hours. It's terrible, man. The difficulty of letting go of my last patients was very painful space. Anyway, I came back from whatever that was, and this patient said to me, "You've changed." I mean, just as matter-of-factly as anything you can imagine, "You've changed." Which meant to me that she could feel that my intense focus on our work was less intense.
And yes.
Yeah, right?
Uh-huh.
So anyway, that's the patient who then asked me if I would consult with her and her partner.
Consult with her and her partner in that business.
In her business.
In her business, yeah. So let me go back because that's, we want to get to that. That's included in the paper that I was referring to.
Right.
But I want to go back to this transition that occurred in you that you described, because there are a number of people in the audience that have made this transition really from practicing psychoanalyst to working with organizations and with leaders.
Right.
And so I want to, if you could talk a bit more about the impact of this particular conference and how it made you think differently and how that led into this work with the patient. I want to just quote one sentence here in the paper.
Mm-hmm.
"I understood through the role analysis that I had placed myself in mediocre working circumstance with little authority and little opportunity to operationalize my own competence and value system and the value system that the program purported to represent in order to keep alive a transference longing and a vain hope that my talents would be discovered, a vain hope that I would be elevated, chosen, found, brought along, given a place."
Exactly. So that was the developmental hurdle I was facing, that before that moment, I had been plucked, chosen, brought along, given opportunities, and that started with the Jesuits. That's why I wanted to be one of them. You know, they gave me opportunities to have speaking engagements and to talk about the school, and you know. So, in my first job, somebody found me and asked me if I would please do this job. And then I was on that job, and NYU came and plucked me out of that job. You know, it's like I had no agency. I just had whatever it was people wanted, and I could say dumbly, "Oh, okay, you know, of course I could be an assistant provost," as if I knew anything about that work. So what changed was a sort of observation of myself as basically, you'll have to edit this out, chicken shit in life. It's like just letting life roll me along, and pretty, you know, life was rolling me along pretty nicely. I didn't have any complaints. I could even be kind of proud of myself. And I was missing altogether that I was like hapless, you know, like, and who are you and what do you stand for? And, you know, what's your contribution? And, you know, look, I was raised Catholic, so making contribution is part of the thing. So I wasn't making any contribution other than going along with the flow. And one of the flows happened to be that this happened twice in my career while I was an analyst, that two organizations of white guys, one a firm and one just a collection of guys who work together, sort of said, Kathy, we know this is tokenism and, you know, you can get us back anytime you like, but please, could you join us on this call? Because we can't go in as a group of white guys. And so, sure, of course, all right. What I didn't understand, though, was that in doing that, it was awakening my understanding that I was a natural for consultation work. Because it's not all that different from psychoanalytic work, right? It's just a different language and a different cadence. And so these guys who were not psychoanalysts were like, oh my God, we really need this kind of thing on the team. And so there was a pull, as well as my own initiative, there was a pull for me to come out and, stand on my own 2 feet for what I think, believe, and understand. And all of it has to do with psychoanalysis, right? That's who I am innately. And by the way, you know, the Tavistock work is all based in psychoanalysis as well. So it's just another cut on the same beloved work. So it's very risky when you say to people, oh, sure, I can come and join you on, let's see, what's this one? The first one was the Mercedes-Benz windshield wiper manufacturing company in Germany. Mm-hmm. Oh, sure, I can go act like I know exactly what I'm doing. Oh, my God. So it was thrilling. I had a great time, you know, because I do know a lot of stuff that is useful for Mercedes-Benz windshield wiping company. One of them was about the unconscious enactments that were going on that were repeating, you know, annually. So any psychoanalyst would go and see that, right? But then forming your mouth, forming your thoughts, forming your guts, forming your heart to say something like that was the training. And again, you know, I really do think of the psychoanalysis I do is applied psychoanalysis. It just changes the language for the client to suit the client, right? I feel like I've drifted off the point.
Oh, so back to the conference for a moment, because that conference that you went to, it occurred at a particular time in your analysis,
yes,
near the termination phase of your analysis. And I think the paper kind of beautifully describes what that conference did for you experientially at that moment. And there's a parallel between what that conference did for you and parallels with your work with the patient, also described in the paper, where you felt that it was going to be helpful to change the frame from an analytic frame to a consulting frame and then back to an analytic frame.
That's right. You know what else it corresponds to? That the change in my analysis went from, I'm not actually a patient, I'm just a lump here reporting, to being a patient. I really understood the work. I didn't understand the work until after that conference at the TAVI. It's like I could take advantage of the opportunity I was having, to speed along. It was very wonderful. You know, my analyst wrote a paper with two other analysts about their experience of working with three women of color during the Martin Luther King funeral. So we were, these other two women and I were in analysis when Martin Luther King was killed. And so these guys got together and compared their experience. It's a very interesting paper, actually.
Well, we'll definitely, do you remember the name of it? Because we'd like to include that for sure.
I don't, but let me just make another note to myself because I have it. I'll just send it to you. My analyst turned out to become the head of the Columbia Psychoanalytic, and he has passed away now. But I gave a talk at the New York Psychoanalytic and intoned his name, and so many people came up to say their remembrances of him. So it's very close to my heart, this situation.
Would you intone his name again?
Wayne Myers.
Okay, very good. So let me just go back then, Kathy, to this parallel that you're describing, because in the paper, the patient doesn't begin her, quote, real analysis until you have consulted to her and her partner, and you have seen certain things about her in that consulting role that you hadn't really seen in the analysis.
Exactly. To the point, what I saw in the analysis was a person who was kind of wedded to the depressive position and meek-ish and without agency. And no matter how many observations we could make about Wright started her own business, successfully married and raising children and on and on. I mean, she had plenty of agency. But there was a way in which she couldn't own an aspect of herself. So, you know, once you see her at work, it's like, you know, it's undeniable. So it's sort of like knowing that it was being seen, she could not easily deny some of the powerful capabilities that she had, both in terms of use of her aggression and business savvy, all that. So yes, it was incredible. Like, oh my God, when you see people at work, you really do see a lot more than you see on the couch. That's another, you know, feather in the consulting cap, which is, I think I'm doing psychoanalysis and I see much more than I would see if that person were on my couch. And, you know, the thing about ongoing, mostly my practice is ongoing same clients over time, right? So you work for a year and a half to do something, then 5 years later, you go back and do something else. That's sort of the pattern I seem to be in. And so, you know, you're holding understanding that is, again, useful, you know, at some other juncture. And it seems, it feels to me like exactly the same work, different vocabulary. Also, different freedom of expression and affection and humor and, you know, just more of the person I am is at play in the work.
You do make allusion in that paper to the idea that perhaps these issues could have been addressed in the analysis without the consulting part of that work, but I was not convinced.
You were. Right. Yeah, I guess I wasn't either. I didn't go there. No, this is a very defended woman with, you know, a life. And so, in a way, it was her defensive strategy was the same as mine back in the day, which was, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. But, okay, you want to do more with your life? You want to be a little more, you know, available to your husband? You want to think about other kind of work? I mean, you need all of your tools if you're going to do a fuller life.
She was in lockdown as well.
She was in lockdown. Absolutely right. And for a long time. And, you know, I say, well, maybe she had the wrong analyst, you know. But she chose me because she had good feedback about me from her husband, who's a psychiatrist that I have met along the way. And so I think I was a safe choice.
You know, Kathy, I'd like to shift gears, if we might, for a minute. There's obviously a strong connection between the paper that we're talking about and the paper that I'm going to allude to now, which is Surviving Hating and Being Hated, Some Personal Thoughts About Racism from a Psychoanalytic Perspective, which you published in 2002.
Right.
And as I said, there's a definite connection between those two papers. But I did want to spend some time talking about this latter paper and how it fits in your personal as well as consulting life.
Mm-hmm.
It's a paper that has been cited quite frequently recently for very obvious reasons, but it is a paper also that it's chilling, really, when you read it. It could have been written yesterday.
Yeah, it's amazing. It does say something about our cultural cycles. And there's one I'd like to tell you about before we move into the paper. So in the late 50s and 60s, we had the Black Panthers, who were over the 60s, heading toward the 70s, moving from violence to education, right? They put up their university, et cetera. And so the public acceptance, quote, of essentially an aspect of Black life was growing. Life was a little less horrible in terms of racial tensions. And one could see that maybe Dr. King's way was going to take sway. And then a woman burned her bra. and the women's movement, like, came on the scene with force. And of course, the shift in the sort of Black world of becoming citizens ended in people's interest. Now, who gave a shit anymore? Pardon me. Okay, and for a woman who is Black and female, right, it's like you could get some conflicts going. But fast forward, we started to worry about the fact that so many Black men are in, lockdown, slavery fashion, and so many Black men are being killed on the street. This is like in 2014. And the concern was getting to the papers, and then Me Too movement happened. And the interest in Black folks and all like that went dormant until a man had a knee on his neck. So what it says to me, like cyclically, it's the tendency to support sort of the white status quo, which is white supremacy, is supported by the sort of back and forth interest between these two minority groups. And it's so stunning. It's just so stunning that actually I didn't see it until, like just as a normal person who reads the papers, I didn't see it until we were in COVID-19. And then George Floyd, and then, So, that's all about hatred and how it kind of works systemically, but it's hard to put one's finger on it to say, this is the part of the system where hatred lives, right? And if we could just discuss it, see it, own it, that we might get out of this cycle of Black people and women being used to support the ongoing white supremacy.
So you're talking about a split between the minorities here. Is that?
Yes. The implication is that neither group can get much traction because the other group comes on the scene, and takes kind of, quote, the spotlight or takes the media attention. You can't really, really make changes culturally without the media's help, right? And the disappointment, that you can see on people's faces when it's like, oh my God, they forgot all about us when the women were wearing their pussy hats. It's like, well, that's the end of black people, I guess. You know, so that's what I'm talking about. It is a systemic pattern that goes unnoticed, I think, until somebody gets hit in the face with it.
I see. Yes. We're coming to a close, Kathy, but before we do, I did want to give your chance to speak some about your current work, particularly your consulting work in the area of diversity, in the area of race, and how you're approaching the problem with your clients currently.
So, as you can imagine, with the intersection of COVID-19 and Black Lives Matter protests that became global, there's been a drop in defensive understanding. It's like, oh yeah, we have work to do. So the pull for me and for other consultants of color to start to work with the question of how do you even unearth the policies that keep people from succeeding, that keep people, in second class roles, et cetera, et cetera. How do you even begin? So that's where I am right now with several organizations. In terms of home organizations, so I'm just, sitting on a number of task forces trying to think. But for clients, it's opening up the conversation that, yes, this is not an anti-racist organization, and let's count the ways. So people are actually open to figuring that it's discussable. Oh my God, I can't tell you how fantastic that is. And open to the point where I am taking the liberty to say, our country was founded on the genocide of the First Peoples, and then the enslavement of people brought here to do slave labor for the economy. So how could any institution born from white supremacy like that be devoid of the DNA? Has to be there. And I feel that way about me and you and everybody else, that we have a way in which the supremacist way of thinking is alive. And so if you get an organization to even take that on board, then it's pretty easy to say, so let's think about this policy of I know my favorite one is it's sort of the balancing of the races. Let's get more black people in here. It's like, and then you look at the exit problems and the same number of people coming in or going out who are people of color, right? So that then opens up a question of how is that happening? What is, so as you see, it's like digging for gold. It's like one layer, then another layer. And I have a friend who's an OD person who says, in their way of thinking, you ask the five whys. Why is that? Why is that? Oh, okay, then why? And it is kind of like that. It's like trying to peel the onion back to something that is actionable. So that's kind of what I'm doing. I'm in conversation with the people who run their organizations and helping them take on the fact that there's accountability, social accountability for how people are treated.
And what do you feel that, as a psychoanalyst, you bring specifically to how you're approaching the problem of racism in these organizations?
Well, I think one of the things we do as psychoanalysts is we stay curious, and you know, we don't fall for much, and it's like benign skepticism that's at work all the time, right? It's like, oh yeah, is that what you think? Oh, well, tell me more about that. So that is what I did as a you know, lie on the couch, tell me about your mother, right? I wondered about stuff and wondering out loud. And sometimes wondering out loud is the intervention because people haven't thought about it before. And so that's the psychoanalytic training in me. And it's probably the paranoid training from my childhood, but it's the training that I rely on. And also there's the other thing I think analysts bring that I take to the consulting room, and that is I can listen to anything. You know, the way in which my work boundaries work is that I can hear the dirty stories without judgment. And there must be a way that I signal that because I have heard some stories.
Well, Kathy, listen, I really want to thank you so much for this conversation. It's really been fascinating and incredibly rich, and we really appreciate it. Like I said, we will have all the references and the papers that we spoke about available at ipaoffthecouch.org. And I want to thank you very much again for participating in this podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. As always, it was a pleasure talking to you.
Thank you for listening. If I may, I'd like to ask you to help us publicize our podcast by rating us on iTunes or simply sharing it with a friend. You can also visit our webpage, ipaoffthecouch.org, where you can both subscribe and also add your comments. I'd also like to acknowledge the lovely rendition of Beethoven's Opus 18th String Quartet by the Allegri String Quartet on the Vivat label.